Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The comedian Louis C.K. is on his first tour since a sexual misconduct scandal early in the Me Too movement. Now, the details are hardly pleasant to hear about, so heads up, especially if you're listening with kids. The gist of it is that in 2017, after some years of rumors, a number of female comedians came forward and charged that Louis had exposed himself and masturbated in front of them. Louis didn't deny this for the most part, but claims that he believed that these women were consenting. The New Yorker's Hilton Alls went to see Louis C.K.'s show just as the tour began. Not long ago, you exchanged the high seat of drama critic of the New Yorker for a more generalized criticism. You wanted to get out and see more different things.
Yes.
Great. And so instead of being at the Vivian Beaumont Theater or the Winter Garden, you found yourself at the Yuck Yuck Club, a small comedy club on the Canadian side of Niagara Falls.
Have you ever been?
Not yet.
Yeah.
Watching Louis C.K. trying to gin up a comeback tour. Why was this an event worth getting on an airplane for? Why is it important?
Because Louis C.K. is a really significant artist. And I don't mean just in terms of stand-up or situation comedy. He was a fantastic writer. And also, I think, an incredible politician about race.
I get the distinct feeling that you're just trying to acquire a black friend. Yes, that's exactly what I'm doing. But I'm not doing it for me. I'm doing it for my daughter.
I think his show, where he was co-parenting with his black ex-wife, was one of the more...
This is the FX show, Louis.
Yes. Yeah. Was one of the more astounding things I had ever seen in this culture about race being what you made of it. The thing that was so profound for me as a viewer was that his wife was black and he never mentioned it. It was one of those things that every week there would be 2 to 3 people of color who would call me and say, did you see that thing? Like, he never said it. He never said it. So
right, it's not even a plot point.
It's not anything, you know, and we were able to see him and to see her as humans interacting with each other. It was one of the more liberating things I've ever seen.
But even so, he's got a big career, and then all of a sudden, 2017, 5 women accused C.K. of sexual misconduct, which in some cases involved masturbating in front of them.
Yes.
And that led to FX. They ended their relationship with him. His film, I Love You, Daddy, was shelved. Animated series that TBS was going to do canceled. HBO canceled some comedy specials, as did Netflix. His longtime manager dumped him. The Disney Channel redubbed his voice in reruns of the animated shows Gravity Falls. In other words... End of career, it seemed.
Right.
And then you find yourself in Niagara Falls at the Yuck Yuck Club.
Yes.
And you get into this room, and he takes the microphone, and it's a typical comedy club. And how did he do?
Not so good. There were brilliant things about, you know, going to an antique shop and how much he hates the sound of the bell over the antique shop, and also having dinner by himself in a Chinese restaurant, and then talking about, it was actually very moving, imitating the woman who was talking to him, who owned the Chinese restaurant, who was Chinese, and he said, I'm quoting her, I'm not making fun of her accent. And then there was a lovely, incredibly smart moment, I would say about a minute, where he talked about imitating other people. So there were flashes of it, but nothing really sort of added up to a script. Mm-hmm. There was no spine to it at all. He was sort of throwing out information and bits, and it was up to us to hold on to them to try to figure out what he wanted to do. He's really sort of trying to not revitalize who he was, but to establish something new in terms of persona. And the persona wasn't the sort of idiosyncratic everyman. It was, now he was a bro dude, and he had gotten caught with his hand in the cookie jar, so to speak. And so he was playing to that audience. He was playing to the stand-up comedians who opened for him, who made dick jokes, who talked about, you know, the science fiction aspect for them of female genitalia. It was all of that sort of smutty 13-year-old boy.
So he's not there to apologize in any way.
He didn't apologize, and he didn't actually make any credible comedic situation to explain what his life had been. For instance, someone that we both love, Richard Pryor, would have become A, the dick, B, the woman, C, Louis looking at the woman, D, the dick looking at Louis. I mean, he would have covered all the bases. Louis just sort of makes a statement about it, and then he goes on to not very interesting situational comedy.
Yeah. So he gets there, and he brings up, he says, if I remember from your piece, do you want to talk about the thing?
Yes.
Well, describe that moment, because that's the key moment in his act.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about the thing?
And the audience cheered and roared, and he said, I can't tell you. This is where he made a mistake as a comedian. He says, I can't tell you much about the experience, except if you ask someone, may I masturbate in front of you, and they say, okay, don't believe them. If they say that they're fine with it, don't believe them. And I think had he used the brilliance that we were so accustomed to, he would have looked past those words and said, I wanted to believe them. And then the bit would have gone on to say, to describe what that was like for him, why it was transgressive, why he wanted to be caught, why a million other things that happen subconsciously when you do stuff in public. So he never went past those words, not even an apology. He was sort of saying, don't do it, guys. It wasn't an apology. It wasn't really a mea culpa. It was a statement.
Is there a generational divide or a political divide when it comes to how people view this comeback of Louis C.K.'s or other?
It was a much younger crowd than I expected, and
very male, right?
I think I would say safely 2/3 of the audience was male and white,
and
I'd say under 40. And I had the panic that you cannot show that no black person in America can show when you walk into the room and you are the only person of color there. I was so relieved at the end of the performance that there was a man of color handing out tickets near the men's room.
There you were.
There we were.
So the audience is white, very male, and also younger. And what you're saying is that the younger audience is somehow more forgiving. In that limited experience.
They might not remember his show by now. I mean, 2015 is a long time ago for a young person.
Right.
They might not remember the show. They remember the controversy.
You write in the article that I am interested in performers who try to work through the difficulties in their own lives by addressing them in art.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the big question. Did Louis C.K. succeed at spinning his troubles into anything like art?
No, what he made me do was miss him.
The old one.
Yeah. Meaning I missed his ability to do situational comedy. This was stand-up, which is very different. Stand-up is a series of jokes, and if you hit on a joke that the audience likes, you can tell a story that goes along with it. His real genius and his gift is for situational comedy, to describe taking a car trip with his kids, or to describe, as he does in this show, brilliantly going to an antique shop. He gives so little of that now because I think he's afraid that the audience that he has simply doesn't have the attention span to follow a story from A to Z. As opposed, when he said, I used to play stadiums, that was much more diverse, larger crowd. You're walking around with that mic and you're talking to many different kinds of people. It's sort of like jazz singing. You know, you're doing the notes, you're doing the scales, you're doing the orchestration. When you're working in a club like this and you're aware that there's a lower common denominator in terms of audience response, you start to play down. A lot of great comedians, and I'm thinking of amazing people like Lily Tomlin, Richard Pryor, Sandra Bernhardt, they don't bring the material down to the audience, they bring the audience up.
What were you waiting to hear from him, in a way? You'd come to the Yacht Club, obviously, to not just to review a show, but to review
a phenomenon,
kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really wanted him to describe himself. I wanted him to be the Louis that I loved, which the person who would have described what those situations were like, not passing any judgment at all on the women, but what his compulsion was. Where did it start? Why was it important for him to masturbate and not be alone? What was it, a performance? Did he want them to like him?
Does somebody like that owe his audience and owe anybody?
I think that, like all of us, we owe a certain level of best foot forward to everyone that we're in conversation with in the world. And he wasn't putting any foot forward. He was just kind of dropping the mic, picking it up, dropping the mic and picking it up.
Do you think he's done?
I don't want him to be, actually. There are so few people out there who can use language, and there are so many of us who make mistakes and so many people who suffer. If he could do something, not to redeem himself, but to redeem our belief in him and redeem the lives of those people that he hurt and scarred, he can do it through his art, if he does his art.
Hilton Alls is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Louis C.K. is on tour in Houston and elsewhere.
So let me tell you the story of when I was coming back over the Canadian border to go to Buffalo to go to bed. I'm in the back of the taxi going from the Canadian side back to the U.S. to go to my hotel.
In Buffalo.
In Buffalo. And there was a guard, very nice guard, I've never had this experience with law enforcement in my life.
This is at Customs.
Yes. Yeah. And he sees me in the back of the car and my eyes are watering because of the weather. And he says, why were you here? And I said, I went to see Louis C.K. at the Yucca Comedy Club. And he said, why did you come all the way here? And he said, oh, wait, because of the thing? And I said, yes. And then he said, are you crying? And I said, no. He said, and then he handed me a box of tissues. So it was all worth it.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and together we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. One of the marquee issues of the 2020 Democratic campaign has been taxes. Not tax cuts, but higher taxes on the wealthiest Americans. That issue is a cornerstone of the Warren and the Sanders campaign. But these days, you don't have to be a socialist to talk about income inequality as a severe problem.
Let's talk about how to tax the rich. Woohoo!
This is a meeting that took place a couple of months ago in San Francisco.
Thank you for being here today and taking part in this incredibly important conversation. It's time for America's millionaires to start stepping up and tackling inequality head on.
Morris Pearl, who's at the mic here, is not exactly your stereotype of a fired-up leftist. He is really rich, and he's not shy in admitting it.
being rich is great. I've done it. I recommend you all try it. It's a lot better than the alternative. And I'm not here to talk to you about altruism.
Pearl is the chair of a group that calls itself the Patriotic Millionaires. And he spoke recently with Sheila Kolhatkar, who reports for us on business and the economy.
The Patriotic Millionaires really tap into several things that I'm obsessed with right now. Income inequality, the political debate over how to address income inequality, and the ways that some wealthy people and successful business executives are struggling over how they might play a part in solving this problem. To see a group of these people really sort of publicly advocating for policies that would potentially cost them money, at least in the short term, I thought was really interesting and not something you see very often.
The main issue we're trying to address is the fact that this growing inequality, this having a country with a few rich people, lots of poor people, is not going to work in the long term.
That's Morris Pearl. He's the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires.
Having no middle class doesn't work for the rich people. We make money from our investments when there's millions of people paying their bills on time every month. So that's the overall rubric. We're trying to address that with three policy areas. One is progressive taxation. We're in favor of rich people having higher tax rates than regular people, not the other way around. We're in favor of higher wages for working people. We think that people who work full-time should make enough money to live on.
An argument you typically hear around this issue is that it will hurt small businesses, that small business owners can't afford to pay employees more. They can't afford to pay sick leave.
If small business people are thinking about the minimum wage, they should also think about their customers getting raises. And so if you look at a small business like a restaurant, having the customers with more beer money in their pockets on Friday nights is a lot more important and makes a much bigger difference than how much wages the one guy standing behind the bar pouring the beer is making. So we're in favor of higher minimum wages. And we're also wanting to reduce the influence of big money in politics. We would like to take money out of politics, especially my personal money.
In the past, we've tended to think of wealthy people as wanting one set of policies that benefit them, and then lower-income people wanting a different set of things, higher wages, for example. The Patriotic Millionaires are making the argument that what's good for the people who are lower down the economic ladder is actually better for the people at the top. Morris Pearl grew up as part of a middle-class family in upstate New York, and he actually discovered a passion for computer programming when he was in college. So he became a computer scientist, and he ended up working at a series of Wall Street firms doing complex analysis and helping to design different bond instruments.
I did investment banking work. I fell into sort of the beginning of the securitization field, working on issuing what was called collateralized mortgage obligations, or still is called collateralized mortgage obligations. And that's what I was doing, and I loved doing it. And I was writing big computer programs, and I was helping my friends and myself get rich at the same time. I mean, what's not to love?
A collateralized mortgage obligation is a type of debt instrument that's made up of a bunch of mortgages that are bundled together and turned into an investment. And they played a significant role in causing the financial crisis. Although Morris did become very wealthy, in part by helping to design some of these debt instruments, he never thought of his work in political terms, and he certainly never thought about his wealth as being connected in any way to politics. He really wasn't political at all until his wife got connected with the Howard Dean campaign in 2004.
He was campaigning on sort of against being at war with Iraq. In my mind, it was an opportunity to do something as opposed to just hanging around complaining. And we wanted to go see the convention in Boston that year. And I thought we could watch on TV, but a few phone calls later and a few tens of thousands of dollars later, we were ensconced at the Four Seasons Hotel and playing pool with Ben Affleck and sitting in the upper deck when the skinny guy from Chicago gave his Purple State speech.
The pundits like to slice and dice our country. into red states and blue states. Red states for Republicans, blue states for Democrats. But I've got news for them, too. We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states.
So you learn pretty quickly about the power of money in terms of generating political access, it sounds like.
Access, yeah. I mean, for a few tens of thousands of dollars, you can become anybody's best friend.
After the financial crisis, Morris worked as part of a group that traveled around the world and helped countries value problematic debt that they were struggling to deal with. This work that he was doing led him to a meeting in Athens where he had a kind of epiphany.
We were in the top floor of this fancy office building on Sophocleus, right in downtown Athens. And I was picking up some chocolate pudding for dessert. I kind of walked to the window so people wouldn't see I was having two chocolate puddings for dessert. And then I I thought I was watching a parade. I was thinking to myself, well, it's not a holiday or we wouldn't be working today if it was a holiday. Why is there a parade? Then I realized they were having a demonstration. And I kind of turned around finishing dessert and I looked around. And I thought to myself, is it really doing any good for the rest of the people of Greece other than these guys who are trying to run this bank, which we were trying to help? And, you know, a few months later, in early 2014, I just started doing politics and policy work full time. I just thought that was the best way I could contribute to the well-being of, you know, my children and hopefully grandchildren.
Did the Patriotic Millionaires find you initially, or did you find them?
I'd been enjoying getting involved in politics here and there. I'd been meeting a lot of people, some bright, young PR professional people started this group to get a bunch of wealthy people together and put out a letter saying, no, our taxes should not be lowered.
A set of tax cuts, including cuts for the very rich that had been passed by George W. Bush, were set to expire around halfway through President Obama's first term. This was before Morris became chairman of the group.
And he thought we were kind of dorks for attacking him from the left, or at least that's what Ms. Jarrett said he thought. But then they realized that we were actually helping to give them political space to do what they actually wanted to do. Our group is different than a lot of other advocacy groups. There are groups that can mobilize hundreds of people. We don't have hundreds of people in any one city. I don't think I could get 20 people in any one room. But we do have dozens of people who can, like that, get members of Congress on the phone for 5 minutes to explain to them why they should vote for the Raise the Wage Act. So we are in a different position than of other advocacy groups, and we try to do what we can to help make progress.
What's the argument you make to someone like you who may not currently see things the way you do?
Well, I try to make the same arguments that I make with you. I explain that the current system is leading towards civil unrest. I saw it on the streets in Athens, Greece, the cradle of democracy. I saw it on election night in 2016. People are not accepting the status quo. And eventually, people are going to say, we're not going to take it anymore. You know, gross inequality did not end well in South Africa for the rich people either.
There are other groups that help wealthy people use their money more responsibly, that promote socially aware investing, for example. But I'm not aware of any groups that are as high profile and politically active as the Patriotic Millionaires. I think a big part of what it's going to take to really make structural changes in the economy that will help alleviate some of the really alarming disparity that we've seen is to create a sort of cultural change around this subject. And having a group of wealthy, successful business people, heirs to family fortunes, going out and talking about this helps create a climate where these ideas are much more acceptable. They help counter the idea that the winners in our economy want one system and everyone else wants something else. I read a piece that you wrote expressing support for Elizabeth Warren's proposed wealth tax. Why do you think that could potentially work?
Now, Warren Buffett pointed out that he pays a lower tax rate than his assistant. Yet Warren Buffett had about $12 million of taxable income the last year that I checked. But really, his wealth increased by billions of dollars that year and almost every year. No amount of taxes on what we call taxable income would have any material effect on the wealth of someone like Mr. Buffett. So that's why a wealth tax would be an important part of this. Over the course of some years, the very wealthiest would be paying in more of their money. And the rest of the people would have to shoulder a smaller piece of the burden of whatever amount of revenue the government needs to run the country.
If you potentially would have to pay such a tax, would you still support it?
Yes. You know, I don't particularly want to pay more taxes personally, but I want the system to be fair, and I want my children, and now I have a grandchild, to grow up with the kind of opportunities that I had. That's what I really want. I mean, what's the purpose of making money if not to make the lives of your children better?
Morris Pearl, a former managing director of BlackRock and the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires. He spoke with Sheila Kolhatkar, a staff writer at The New Yorker. I'm David Remnick, and that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Karen Frillman, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino. With help from Danny Bonner, Morgan Flannery, Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing.
Or politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.